Stage with Robert Emery.
Good afternoon, Fred and Richard from Right Said. Fred, welcome to Backstage with Robert Emery.
Hello.
Yeah, I'm very good, thank you very much. Very, very good. It's nice to speak to some rock and rollers, which I don't get to do very often from my line of work. So thank you for coming on board. So look, I just want to give a quick summary. I mean, I'm sure everybody knows you who is going to be watching this, but nevertheless, you were formed in 1989, I was about that tall.
All right.
You've had number one hits in 70 countries, including... Yes. Two US number ones, three UK number ones, and even a number one in Japan. You were the first band to reach number one in the USA since the Beatles, and you've played in front of people.
With the debut record,
With the debut record, and you've played in front of people like the Queen and Nelson Mandela. You've had global record sales totaling about 30 million units, and over 100 million plays on Spotify, and you've been placed in over 50 films and 100. Commercials, but strangely enough, it all started in a basement in Acton, which I know very well. So why? I don't know your basement very well, but I know Acton very well. So there's time yet, Jess. So why don't you tell me a little bit about your time in Acton and how you became to be Right Said Fred?
Okay, The story from Acton is that we've been used to being in bands. We fancied working with someone who does loops and programs music. And we were put in touch with a guy called Brian Pugsley. He worked with the Shaman. He worked from his little basement in Acton. We went over there probably August or September in 1990.
Quite warm.
It was pretty warm at the time, yes. And it was in the basement. We were getting a bit hot and tired and bothered. So we had this track going round. The bass line, it was a song called Heaven, I think. And the bass line actually was the da, 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 da. It's an E major scale, basically.
Yeah.
And at one point, Richard got up and started wandering around and then started singing I'm Too Sexy for My Shirt.
Yes.
I'm Too Sexy for My Shirt, because it was hot.
Yes.
And at that point, he came back and going, I'm too sexy. So singing the bass line with that lyric. And
Mozart,
yes, yeah, Chopin, get out of here,
yeah, get out of it. Get out of my club.
So that was the kernel of the idea.
Yeah.
We then, because we were skint, we had to save up to go into other studios and get the song finished and work with other people. Long story short, we went around the labels with it. Everyone said no. And we then met we were approached by a young girl called Tamsin, who was a receptionist at a recording studio we used. And she said, I think this is a hit record. If we get it on the radio, can I manage you? So I said, yeah. Well, we said, yeah.
So thinking she never would.
And she got it onto Gary Crowley, then onto the Simon Bates Show. And after the Simon Bates Show in particular, which was a morning show on Radio 1, it just went bonkers. The phones went mad and they had to play it again, and suddenly the record just started taking shape. It was very, very bizarre.
And then within a year it was number one in America.
And did you have any expectations? Did you really have any idea of how large you thought it would be?
No, none
at all. We'd sort of given up on the idea of
generally, really.
Yeah.
Life.
Yeah, we'd kind of given up on the whole record label thing. We were sick to death. We'd been in and out of record deals. We'd been turned down by everybody. We were just kind of bored with them, really. So we thought, let's just do this without their involvement. And then it took off, and obviously it caught everybody by surprise.
And did you release it as a single, or was it part of an album?
No. It was a single release.
It's the only song the three of us had.
Yeah, we had one song. Rob, who was also in the band, we hadn't been in a band with Rob for more than about 10 minutes. And our first couple of writing sessions, one of them involved I'm Too Sexy being written. And so we didn't really know Rob. And our record label had never been a record label. Our manager had never been a manager.
We'd never been a band.
And us with Rob had never been a band.
So it was chaos.
Yeah, it was an accident waiting to happen, and it was absolute chaos. The record company had no idea what they were doing, nor did our manager, nor did us, nor did we. It was complete and utter just, let's throw some things at the wall and see what happens.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it was.
I guess you started doing a lot of TV and a lot of radio promo around it. But you had nothing else to sell. You had no other album to sell. No. You had nothing sort of future career lined up. No. You had no idea of where to go. I mean, that sounds like a bit of a nightmare because, as you know, at the moment, you know, you would traditionally create your record and then go on tour and PR your record. And actually, now today's model is about creating your record and that's supporting your tour rather than the other way around. So, but back then, you just had this single and you thought, fuck, what... Yes. What do we do with it?
Well, everybody thought that.
Yes, I mean, what happened? Exactly. I mean, the single just broke incredibly quickly, particularly into other countries and around Europe. And so everyone was, the record label suddenly started sending us songs, saying this is your next single sort of conversation. Yeah. And we said, no, it's not, because we've written the first one and now we're going to write the second one.
Yeah.
So what we did is that we didn't want to try and rewrite another Aren't You Sexy. We thought that was pretty lame. So we wrote Don't Talk, Just Kiss. And we thought it was still a dance track, still very pop, but not quite as quirky. And that's the route we went down. And that proved to be very successful for us, you know, much to the record label's surprise.
Yeah, yeah. Right at the beginning, when we first, the only time I started thinking that I liked the track, I didn't think for a second as to whether it would be a hit. That didn't cross my mind at all. The only time I thought that the track was beginning to work as a track was when Phil Spaulding, the bass player, put live bass down rather than keyboard bass.
Yeah,
yeah.
Once we put live bass down, the track started to hop.
It did, yeah.
And was more rhythmically interesting. So that was the first time I remember thinking, oh, no, I quite like this. But we still didn't think it was going to be a hit, not in a million years.
No.
So what? How long was it until from when you released the single and then it became a hit to having enough material to be able to go on tours and actually perform full gigs?
Well, we were the album was done by 92, sort of March 92.
Yeah.
So we'd put a whole album together in that period, some of which we had already written with Rob after Sexy, like songs like Swan and Deeply Dipping, already sort of kind of written. Then we should have gone on tour. What happened was is that we became celebrities, which we hadn't thought about ever.
We were like the Kardashians without the boom.
Minus the divorce.
Yes, minus the divorce. Yeah. So what happened was is that we suddenly became this sort of household name, and what the record company realised, and it's not a criticism, it's just them realising it, is that Our worth on TV was a lot. So we'd go on TV, almost any TV show, and our album sales would spike heavily. You know, literally an extra 40, 50,000 albums. It was very big numbers. So we got persuaded not to go on the road.
Because that would cost money.
Because that would cost money and we wouldn't be on TV.
Yeah.
So the record company kind of persuaded us. I'm not saying they're wrong. I'm just saying long term it was probably the mistake and short term it was the right idea. So we didn't go on the road until after our second album, which didn't go very well.
Well, I can remember somebody saying, you can't tour on the back of one album.
That was our publisher, John Crawley.
You can't tour on the back of one album. That's what we were told.
Yeah, which was
really
the dumbest advice I've ever heard.
When you start off with a business, you look to people like that for advice and you take their advice because you assume they know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
Many, many years later and many bank overdrafts later that you realise they didn't know what they were talking about at all.
No, it becomes quite self-serving. And, I won't tell you the name of the manager or the artist, but a very famous manager of a very famous artist in the UK contacted us and said, this is going to fall apart because the people around you do not know what they're doing. So he said, you don't have to hire me. Just take my advice and find people with experience because I can tell you now it's going to fall apart.
And did you?
We did. Now he was right.
And it's all apart.
Oh yeah, definitely. And he was absolutely right. But the trouble is when things are going so well, your first record is number one everywhere. Your second record is top five everywhere. Pre-sales for the album and the third single are going mad and, you know, all this stuff. So it's very easy from our point of view, they go, well, why would we stop this? Because this is going really well. And yeah. It's only when things start to unravel, you see people's skills and abilities.
Yeah.
And so he was absolutely right. We should have listened to him, but hindsight's easy, you know.
Yeah.
No, we're not complaining.
But you released that track, though, as a self-release. You did it on your own record label.
Oh, no, it was released on a label called Tug, but it wasn't really a record label. It was just a label set up
for that record.
For that one single.
Okay.
So it wasn't a record company that would already that we got signed by. In fact,
but the point is that you can cream it in because you're able to take the majority of the income rather than give a huge proportion to a manager and a huge proportion to a label and a huge proportion to a fixer and all the other people. You're able to.
Yeah, it leaves you in a strong position when that happens.
Yes, yeah, I mean, we negotiated a pretty decent record deal on our behalf because also we refused to. I mean, I don't think we thought we were being smart, but we were. Quite smart looking back, is that we didn't refuse to sign a record deal. We said we'll do a letter of intent, okay. You know, and that for people who don't know that's saying we'll act in good faith. In the music industry, good faith doesn't stand for much. I've got to be honest.
Yeah.
Or in life general, so it did put us in a strong position because we had no record deal and we had this massive one single.
Yeah.
So we were in quite a strong position. It's easy to criticize looking back. But I think everybody tried their best at the time. It's just if you don't have the skills, trying your best doesn't really matter. You just don't have the skills.
And we didn't really understand the business.
No, we didn't. Really. No.
People do. They duck to water. You know, some people just really understand it from the off.
Yeah.
And we really didn't. It wasn't until the sort of mid to late 90s, really,
yeah,
that we began to get a grip on what the business was like and how we wanted to work and how we wanted to spend the rest of our lives, you know.
Also, there are things that are really important to us. I know it sounds trivial now, but going to the gym is really important to us, partly because we both have depression, but also we like the mental and physical thing strength it gives you. So we would actually turn down promotions saying, no, we've got to go to the gym.
We'd have the gym written into our itinerary.
Yeah.
So instead of M&Ms on your itinerary, you have your gym equipment.
We had gym, yeah.
It's like smoking. It's all better for you, though, obviously. But it's a moment just for you.
It is, yeah.
Gym is just for you. It's not for anybody else.
Because you used to own a gym, didn't you? Or do you used to run it or something?
No, we used to run it.
We were managers.
Managers.
But we also, we didn't realise, but when we took our shirts off in the video, we didn't realise what a sort of a cross to bear
stupid thing to do that
would be, because we just took, the director said, he said, you guys are in great shape. The song says, too sexy for my shirt, take your shirts off.
Yeah.
So, okay. And we were in good shape. We're not being a fake modesty. We knew we were in good shape. So we did that. But we didn't realise that obviously when you go on touring or a promotional tour, and suddenly the gym becomes less and less important because you're so busy.
Less and less possible.
Possible rather is the right word. You start losing size. And there was a really funny moment. There was a very famous model in America, female model called Megan Fox, very famous. And she was I think Penthouse Playgirl of the Year or something like that. And Calvin Klein approached us and her to do this photo shoot. So we turn up at the record company to meet Megan Fox, and we've been on the road promoting, and so we haven't been in the gym. So we walk in, we weren't fat, we were just a lot smaller, and we took our shirts off, and you could see people, you could see on their faces, they're like, oh, is that the time? I think we better reschedule. And Megan Fox was very sweet, she didn't blink an eye, but the photographer and the record company kind of went, oh
yeah. There was a time late, much later on when we were touring, and when we started touring, it was in Germany. And when we started touring, we obviously had people taking photographs and stuff. And at the beginning of the tour, I would take my shirt off halfway through the show, and it was all, you know, it all looked fantastic, blah blah blah. So and at the end of it, after each show, the only thing that was open after a show was a McDonald's. It was the only place.
Oh, no.
I was eating McDonald's for about 2 weeks every night. And I've got pictures of me taking my shirt off at the end of the tour, looking like Gary Glitter.
Minus the prison sentence, slightly larger than life.
I still thought I was in shape.
Yeah.
But
And is exercise still really important for you both?
Yes, very.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we bought some.
I've got a Peloton bike there.
Oh, we've got a friend who just bought one.
And yeah, well, this is the thing. You see, I hate exercise. Right. I like the one thing in life I really hate is exercise. And right. and from about the age of naught to about the age of 26, I was like this stick thin right. pencil. And I could eat anything and I wouldn't bulk up. I wouldn't get fat. Nothing could happen to me. And I never, ever needed to exercise from my body. And it just genuinely didn't make any difference to what I was eating. Yeah. And then I turned 30.
I know what you're going to say.
And literally the day after I turned 30, I suddenly thought, what's happening, what's this little bit of blubber around yeah. and then it's gradually got worse and worse. I'm definitely not a fat guy, but no. you know, I'm having to watch what I eat.
Yeah.
And I try to go to the gym and do weights and all that. I thought, oh God, it's so much like hard work. That's the problem. If you've never done it in your life, it's a bit of a killer to try and start at the age of 31. So yeah. I thought, well, I try this thing in lockdown. I bought it in the last lockdown. And I love it. And it's the only thing that I'm happy to get on for 20 minutes or half an hour a day and zone out and go and do a bike ride.
Exactly. I do the same thing. I've got the little earpod things and I switch on either Sky or not Sky, you know, YouTube and watch all the broadcasts, your Julie Hartley Brewer or whoever it happens to be, Mike Graham. And then when I get bored with that, I just turn on the Spotify app and listen to music. But yeah. I agree with you. Zoning out is really, really good. And one of the things about the whole lockdown thing that was never emphasized enough by politicians who really ought to know better is the importance of exercise for people.
Yeah.
The importance of fresh air and exercise and sleeping properly. These things are so important. And particularly when it comes to depression and anxiety for people.
Yeah.
To encourage people to get out. Even you don't have to be a member of a gym. Just get out of your flat and walk around. It's better to break the guidelines than go completely insane. That was my position.
No, I agree. But talking about depression for a second, obviously this is something that affects an awful lot of people. And one of the things I noticed in the entertainment industry is that people who have had success very early on are very, very prone to depression. And I suspect one of the clear reasons why is because they have an eternal fear that they will never be able to beat what they have already achieved, and that there is this subconscious thing saying, well, the rest of my life is not going to be anywhere near as successful as that little part in time. And that's a hell of a thing to have to try and deal with. And I always think, you know, people who win Olympic medals and you go, well, that's, you know, that is the peak of your physical fitness. That is the peak of your life. You're never, you know, unlikely to ever going to win another Olympic medal, maybe after that one pinnacle. Really? Everything from there is slightly downhill. And how do you adjust your mind to make sure you don't fall into that nasty trap of that depression? How do you deal with it?
Well, personally, I think it depends what you're trying to say when you say it. Exactly.
You know what I mean? I've got your number, mate.
You have indeed. Yeah. You'll come round with your big buff muscles. Yeah.
I think it depends how you judge success. If you judge success by numbers and sales, then I think, first of all, that's a mistake. And also there's, particularly with the way the market is now, you can't compare sales to even 10 years ago. It's just a different animal completely now. So I think with us, we judge our success by how much we control our own lives. That's success to us.
And how we feel about what we're doing.
Yeah, and how we feel about what we're doing and the decisions that we get to make as opposed to other people make them for them. Although we used to make a lot more money than we make now, I'm a much happier, more balanced person. Although I have to keep an eye on my depression, I'm not a manic depressive or anything, but I can control it relatively successfully most days. And so for me, that's success. And success is, you know, my wife, my family, just health. That's success to me.
You know? Exactly.
If I was on my own and a bit messed up but had 20 times as much money, I wouldn't feel more successful.
I think also some people measure their success by the amount of notice they think they get, whether they're in the papers or whether it's lots of photos, whether they're whether they're mentioned in dispatches and all that, you know, you have to, in a way, you have to be prepared to be happy while you're invisible.
Yes.
So you have to work on that.
Yeah.
You can't continually expect to make other people happy or for your happiness to be derived from other people's approval. That cannot be allowed to happen.
Can you tell when each other is kind of on the edge of going through a little bit of a dip? And is there something that you do to try and pick one of you up?
Yes, I think we're quite good at that. I think Fred's more prone to it than me, I think.
I am, yes.
Because I'm essentially more simple.
He's a bit
I'm a bit different. And I just run for along, you know.
Shiny thing.
Yeah, shiny thing.
Yeah. Oh, it's the sun.
Yeah, I think we do. And I think we have each other's backs.
Yeah.
In this industry, it's very, very easy to get lost, to lose yourself and to be surrounded by people. One of the things that I've often thought is that if you come from a fairly stable family background, with good friends, good family, good people around you. When you enter show business of one kind or another, you are inclined to think that everybody's a bit like your family, that they're mostly okay, that they're you know, they're straight dealing. And then you realise after a few years that actually that's not the case at all. It's a sharp call, and you have to keep your eyes open. And that's why a lot of people, solo artists, travel with friends.
Yeah.
Or one or two of your close people, because it grounds you the whole time.
I think having a close girlfriend around or best.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. What's the solution for you as brothers when you fall out, when you're having to make decisions and you feel, or you've got opposing opinions? How do you keep yourself?
Yeah, we don't actually disagree about much.
He thinks I'm great and I don't think he's great.
And that's it.
Yeah. I think I'm great.
Sorry.
Yeah, we do fall out, but it's very, very temporary.
Yeah.
It's because life's too short. And I think, I mean, Richard's partner who died in 2010, they'd been together, 28 years. And his partner, Stuart, had been very ill for 27 of those years. And Mum had Alzheimer's, and my health has been poor over years now and again. So I think sometimes when you've had big stuff in your life, it helps you balance it a little bit. You just think, well, we're not going to argue about this snare drum sound or this TV show. We're just going to take a chill and go and have a glass of wine and everything will be fine.
Yeah. Fantastic. Talking about sexuality and sex, there's a definite theme, isn't there, running through you've got I'm Too Sexy, you've got the album called Sex and Travel, you've got the single Sexaholic, you've got Sexy Bum.
That's true.
Are you sexaholics? Is this just something which you kind of went, well, actually, this sex sells, so this is a great, this is a great spin on it? Or,
I mean, it's a big chunk of people's life, isn't it? I mean, they sell cars cars via sex and perfume and shampoo and everything else. So I suppose, we do have it does rear its head.
Although Sexaholic we didn't write
Sexaholic.
Unfortunately.
But some of it is meant to be sort of fun, like Sexy Bum and I'm Too Sexy.
Yeah.
And other things are like, you know, Sex is the Common Ground is another song we've got, and that is just a little bit darker, I suppose. I don't know really.
We've done a song about friendship.
Yeah, we've done quite a few different
celebrity.
Yeah, we've written songs about other stuff. Yeah. So I think it's a bit quite balanced. But until you mentioned it, I'd never really thought about it. So
really,
yeah, no, I never.
Very interesting.
No, it didn't really. We try not to gender stuff.
Yeah.
So we try not to say he and she too much.
Yeah.
Because we're very aware of the fact that two guys might like the song as lovers and two women might like the song as lovers. So the one area of the sexual content, if you like, where we try not to gender it too much.
Also, he's bisexual, so that makes sense.
Like bisex all the time.
Bisex all the time, yeah. Boom.
That's the worst dad joke I've heard all day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, try the veal. I tend to write most of the lyrics, so I'm quite conscious that he's singing it. So although I'm straight, I don't write, you know.
Are you?
Well, apparently it says so on my passport.
Yeah.
I think we do consciously try and avoid the she thing or the he thing.
Yeah.
And we do a sort of a bit more of a generic thing, I suppose.
We've occasionally done it.
Yeah.
Not often.
No, we had a song called She's My Missus that was written about when I was getting married.
Yeah.
But we don't do it often.
So talking about the sexuality, so you're bisexual.
Yeah.
When did you come out to your family, or did they just always know?
I think Dad suspected before he died.
Right.
And then Mum, I told Mum.
91.
In 91. And I remember, this sounds really stupid, but I remember walking into the local news shop, down the newsagents down in the West Country, and the Sun was all fanned out on the thing. And I was on the front page, and the headline was, "I'm bisexy too." That was the headline. And I just for a moment thought, if I buy all these newspapers, nobody will ever know. My secret, you know.
I knew years before.
Because I met Stuart in 82.
Yeah.
Did you know? Did you have this kind of innate feeling of...
I did a little bit, because I remember we were going to a club. I remember this really well. We're both in this car. We're going to a club, and we just said, "I'm not going to go to that club tonight. I'm going to go to I'm meeting this guy in this bar." And I remember just thinking, "All right,"
yeah,
because I kind of knew, but I didn't know. I never gave it much thought, really.
No,
yeah.
I mean, I've always
don't really care.
I had a girlfriend a few years ago, and we clicked really, really well. I mean, we definitely did. In fact, I think I clicked better with her in a weird way than I did with Stuart, although I was with Stuart for much longer. But with her, I never had that sense of closeness. I can't really explain that. But I clicked with her, definitely. We could walk in silence for hours and hours and hours and not feel the need to talk. But for some inexplicable reason, there was a thing missing. I couldn't quite explain it. And so I was with Stuart for 28 years. And, you know, it's... he knew he was gay when he was 12. I didn't really, really absorb the possibility until I was in my late 20s, early 30s.
Gosh, okay. That's incredible. That's incredible. You've had quite a long career now. It's really impressive how long you've been on the block and that you're still going and still happy and still smiling, which is nice, and not taking yourselves too seriously, because that's a really important thing. Do you have any tips and tricks for somebody who wants to start out in the business, looking back where you are now, going, well, do you know what, if you're starting out today, this is what I would do?
If I was starting out today, what I would, if someone asked me about in today's market, hold on to your copyrights as long as you can.
Yeah.
Because that copyright, historically, bands would always give them away with the minute you sign a record deal, and in perpetuity. That's something you need to seriously fight for. Never pay anybody a retainer until they've proven themselves, or just never.
That is really personal experience.
Yeah, that is really
yeah, having done that.
We've got some golden rules which occasionally we've broken, and every time we've broken, we've regretted it.
Yeah.
And I think
work with friends if you can.
Yeah, just try.
Trust.
Yeah, if people like what you do, they will step up and help you out. They just will. They won't. What's the word I'm looking for? You shouldn't have to continually badger them, you know, like with a label or anything. Like, for example, you know, I would say don't go to record labels. Just work your own momentum, get your own songs, hang on to your copyright. And if a deal comes along and it's worth considering, then obviously consider it. But the more valuable you make yourself and your content, the better deal you're going to get.
Yeah, exactly.
Great advice. I'm too sexy.
Yes.
Is it bittersweet? Is it boom? Yes. Is it bittersweet? Because it's obviously the biggest hit of your lives, and you're unlikely to get a hit ever which is as big as that. You know, I quite often hear Elton John talking about your song, which was his, you know, predominant big hit to start with. And he's saying, "I'm so bored of playing the damn thing and Candle in the Wind, but I'll do it because the fans want to. But one day I will stop doing it because I don't want to do it for the 14,000th time." Okay. Do you feel the same way about "I'm Too Sexy"? Is it like, you know, for God's sake, we've done other stuff as well? Or no?
No, I don't.
I don't think Elton John should have said that.
No, personally, if I went to see Elton John, if he didn't play your song, I would hunt him down like a dog. because that is a great song. If I had paid to see him play, I'd want to hear your song. I think it's just a personal thing. Every artist is different. I think there's a contract between you and the audience. You have to understand that people, you know, if I went to see Depeche Mode and they didn't play Enjoy the Silence, I'd be pissed. Yeah. I'd be pissed off about that, and so on with lots of bands. So I think you get. Well, I mean, what we do is we play a big hit, and then we'll play. It's a trade-off. It's hit lesser known song, hit lesser known song, and that's how we do it.
Also, the songs a friend of ours once said to us: once a song's a hit, it no longer just belongs to you.
Oh, that's a really good.
And that's exactly true. And so when Elton John says that, he's being really, really silly. Because your song belongs as much to him as it does to all those other people that bought it and love it.
Yeah.
So he should button it and enjoy it.
Okay. So you've got a new song coming out on March the 12th, which is Your Inner Light is Love.
Yes.
And, you know, I've seen you on the press talking about COVID and the lockdown situation, and we've also already spoken about exercise during lockdown. And I think some of your comments have probably been misunderstood slightly.
Just misquoted, actually.
Yeah,
exactly. So can you just tell us a little bit about that single, why you wrote it, what it's out there for, and what you're hoping to achieve with it?
Okay. The last single was We're All Criminals, which was quite a cynical look at life currently. And we wanted just to exercise that particular thought. Your Inner Light is Love is a much more positive song. And also the doom and gloom is just doing my brain in. So we wanted to write a sing-along, something meaningful. It's about the inner light, which is the best we can do is be as bright and as positive and as warm to each other as we can. If everybody did that, it would be a pretty amazing thing. So The Inner Light is Love is just that. It's a song of unity and coming together and not letting governments get in the way, not letting vaccines get in the way, or your opinion on Brexit, or whether you're a Man United fan or an Arsenal fan, all that, all this stuff is just...
Divides.
It's just ridiculous. So the idea is that there is all, you know, cut away right down to the core of it, we are much more similar than we care to admit. That's the idea of the song, just coming, a song about coming together.
Yeah, the video is out kind of prior to the single release.
Yes.
And we wanted that to be really bright and breezy as well.
So primary colours.
Lots of primary colours and fun. You know, I can't imagine going on stage, although we have done this, where you leave the stage you leave them more miserable than they were when they came in. that's how we started.
God.
but now I like to see people happy. I like to see, which is one of the reasons I don't care for masks, because I cannot see their face.
Yeah.
I cannot see whether they're smiling at me or just scowling. They're scowling. Okay.
Yeah, mostly. It is horrible. Yeah.
I feel I'm being robbed of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know what? When this whole thing started, I created a charity called Get Musicians Working, because as a conductor, I work with thousands of musicians a year, and so many people were writing to me saying, I've got no work, I need to pay the bills, have you got any work that you can give to me, Rob? And I didn't. So I set up this charity, and I've done so much press and PR and radio interviews and television interviews about it. And one of the things that I realized after speaking with somebody, and I was saying, well, you know, music, this whole charity, Get Musicians Working, it's not the most important charity in the world. You know, things like cancer charities, you can't put them, they're not on the same level. And she stopped me and she said, hold on, Rob. She said, music for me is emotional medicine. Without that, I definitely think I would not be here today, because I couldn't be by myself, shielding alone in my flat for the past 12 months if I didn't have the music. And so and that idea of emotional medicine really opened my eyes to actually what, as musicians, what we can achieve and do for people. So I love that you've created such a positive, happy single. It's brilliant. Thank you for doing that. I mean, it's
a pleasure. I've got a much cheaper bike than your Peloton. I've got a much cheaper exercise bike here. But what you're saying is true. It's interesting. If I'm watching the news, I pedal quite slowly.
Yeah.
But music really drives you forward. It really does. And there's a song by Aerosmith called Pink, which off Nine Lives
album,
it just makes me smile. It's just fun, you know. And Steve Tyler is just so
great.
His great sense of humor. So and I agree with you. I absolutely, musical medicine is absolutely true.
Yeah. Just to finish off, because I know we've pushed for time, I've got some quick fire questions. I don't care who answers them, but here we go. So, one person you've never worked with that you always wanted to?
Dead or alive?
Either.
Calvin Harris.
Mine would be Leonard Cohen.
Okay, good. Oh, wow. If you weren't a musician, what would you be?
Politician.
Probably.
Really?
Probably,
Richard would. Yeah. Bars and nightclubs, probably.
Okay, all right. Yeah, if you could have one thing in the world right now, what would it be?
I'd like my wife here.
Okay, yes, where is she?
She's in Barcelona.
Yeah.
Mm. Oh, right. How long have you been separated?
This time only about the moment, just 3 weeks. But our longest separation was 4 months. And when my depression kicked, you know, that go on about that, but she's very good with it. So I would say my wife. Yeah.
And me, it would probably be, I'd like to fall in love again.
That would be nice. I like that. Okay. The proudest moment of your career so far, what is it?
Sitting in an open top hire car in, Miami, going through the radio stations, and it was Sunday afternoon, and we found the chart station, and it said this America's number one this week is Right Said Fred, I'm Too Sexy. So that was, career-wise, that's my proudest moment.
Yeah.
I think for me, it was when we went back to Germany with You're My Mate, because we had a big gap, and then we had another big hit in Germany, in Europe, and I suddenly thought, you know, it helped to stifle all the people who said, you know, that, well, that's been gone, bye-bye kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, I got great satisfaction over that.
Okay, fantastic. And the worst moment of your career so far?
Oh, wow, that's easy.
Worst moment of career so far?
Well, mine was, I had a pair of trousers made out of bubble wrap. And we were doing a gig. We were doing a gig in Cleveland, in America, and they split.
Okay.
yes.
Pop.
It's not something, you wouldn't want to have been at that gig.
No. Fair enough.
Broke a golden rule. We worked with someone we pledged never to work with again. And we ignored that advice. And we were told this person had changed and they hadn't. That was a big mistake.
Lesson learned. A piece of music you wish you'd have written?
Oh, easy.
You never close your eyes anymore.
Okay.
Wow. Oh, tenderness. You've lost that loving feeling.
Yeah.
Great. Great record.
Yeah, and I'd like us to have written Hurt. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. And do you both have a hero?
And it's a who? I think our father, really, for me.
Probably Dad. Okay. He was
a good father and
good guy.
Second World War. And
Right.
Yeah. So last three questions. Number one, what's your most treasured possession?
Oh, that's a good question.
Treasure possession, probably one of my guitars. I'd have to go for 1964 Strat Custom.
Okay. And mine is my watch.
Okay, and what is your watch?
It's a Rolex.
Oh, lovely. Okay, fine. The most outrageous thing you've ever purchased?
Oh.
I spent £2,500 on a pair of leather trousers.
Yeah, we both did that.
Hot.
Yeah. I don't ask me why. Because the only thing I'd have to say about them, they lasted about 18 years.
Yes.
Oh, so wow. Well, that's value for money then.
It is. And I wore them at a lot of shows.
Yeah.
I suppose that was quite outrageous. And anything else? Yes, one thing. When I bought my first house, it's the first house I ever owned.
Oh, the fridge.
I love kitchen appliances. I think they're fantastic. So I went up to Peter Jones and I said, show me your biggest, most fantastic fridge, which they did. And I said, can you deliver it? Yes, they did. It arrived at my house. It wouldn't go through the door, wouldn't go through the window. It was huge.
It was, like an industrial
fridge. Yeah. And so it sat outside my house for about 3 months, just in the wrapper. And I had no idea what to do with that. They wouldn't take it back, obviously, because it had been sitting outside of me. Yeah. And a local restaurant opened up and he said, I've seen that outside your house. Do you want to flog it? I got rid of it for 200 quid. It cost me about 7 or 8 grand.
It's like, oh, my word.
Man, what an idiot. I mean, just, you know, I was so excited about the house. I didn't think to measure things up.
We did that with a bed, but we just took out the window. To get the bed in.
Yes, exactly.
And lastly, the one thing that you can't live without.
I think music.
Music,
actually. Yeah. I think I'd go mad if I couldn't listen to music.
Yeah, or play it.
Yep.
All right. Well, look, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate you. You're superstars and you're lovely people as well, which is even more important. So I really appreciate that. Actually, I lied. There is one more thing.
Okay.
When are you going to do a record with an orchestra?
Well, I was going to beat you to it.
We were meant to do one last year.
Yeah.
With the Berlin Philharmonic?
Berlin Philharmonic.
We were due to do a gig last year, but because of COVID, it got cancelled. And we were meant to do it, yeah.
Yeah. We would love to if you would be up for it.
But please invite us. That'd be lovely.
Yes.
Well, we should have another conversation then.
We should. Absolutely.
I've got lots of ideas. Let's do that.
All right, wicked. All right.
That'd be great.
Let's do that. All right. Yeah. Well, gents, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And good luck with the single. I'm sure everybody's going to love it. It's a ray of sunshine.
Thank you, Robert. Thank you.
Thank you. Cheers. All the best. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.